Jerry Weaver, I'm an alcoholic. It's Friday, July the 2nd, 1989. I've got a home group. My home group is a group called There Is a Solution. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays in Cary, North Carolina, 7 p.m. at the Methodist Church. If you're ever in the Raleigh area, come check us out. It's a good group. And I've got a sponsor. Two things I've always done since I got sober is I've always had a sponsor. I've always had a home group, and I've always stayed consistent and current with both. And for me, it's I've done a lot of crazy things sober, but two things I've always stayed with is a sponsor and a home group, and they have served me well. Good morning, everybody. Appreciate being asked. Jay, thank you. And it's been a great weekend. I've had three good friends come with me from North Carolina, and we've had a great time. Appreciate all the Rush and Ron and all the presenters and the discussion that we've had. It's been a great weekend, great facility. The friendliness and the fellowship and making us feel welcome is awesome. Been a lot of talk about God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. Bill, thanks for the bowl meditation. I've never done that. When we first saw it on the agenda, I thought we were going to like smoke a bowl and meditate together. Do it California style, you know. No offense, Ron. That's right. Yeah, California sober, right? I was like, I didn't know they did that in Atlanta. But anyway. I enjoyed it. We're trying to talk Aaron into buying some bowls and learning how to do it. It was pretty impressive, actually. I think that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, is God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. And that certainly has been my experience, is that I had, prior to being 12-step by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in a detox, had a lot of people try to help me get my life in order. Had a lot of people try to help me stay sober or get sober without any knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous or even really what was wrong with me. And numerous preachers, high school principals, chiefs of police, sheriffs, mom, dad, wife, wife's parents, they tried really hard. Couple, you know, neighbors and family friends. I think a couple dogs and cats even tried and you know, none of it never worked. I mean, the best I could ever stay sober was about 3 days. And you know, one day I was sitting in a detox, really not knowing what was wrong with me. All I knew was that I drank a lot and that I used a lot of booger sugar and I hurt people. And a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came in and talked to me. And it was very different than any conversation I had with anyone else. He didn't come in, he didn't ask me how I was doing or ask me a bunch of questions. He just talked about himself. I think we like to do that. But he talked about how he drank and things that he'd done. And he talked about, I didn't understand what he was saying, but he talked about the mental obsession and how alcoholics are different. And I identified with what he was telling me. When he talked about the struggles and some of the things that he'd done and how he would continue to turn to drinking when he knew that he shouldn't, there was an identification there that with that guy that I had never gotten from anyone else. And that helped me understand that, I guess, number one, I wasn't alone, and that I wasn't the only one that had felt the way that I had felt. And It wasn't magical or mystical. I wasn't happy to be sitting where I was at, but I was somewhat relieved to know that there was another guy that understood. And I was glad to know kind of what was finally wrong with me was he told me that if I was like him, I had alcoholism. And that what that meant was that when I start drinking, I can't stop. And that I got a mind that tells me it's okay to do it. And man, if you'd asked me, I would have told you that's not what's wrong with me. It's that crazy wife that's sleeping with my cousin that's part of the problem, and that, you know, the way I was raised, I was, you know, I had low self-esteem because my dad moved me around a lot, and he cheated on my mom, and he was abusive, and, you know, the Harnett County Sheriff won't stop coming around accusing me of stuff that I've not done. I've done all of it, but the idea that I have alcoholism just didn't make that much sense. But it was the first time anybody had ever said anything like that to me. And my life changed. I've been sober ever since that moment. And I'm a guy that I was 22 years old at that time, and I was told that Alcoholics Anonymous to solve all my problems. I was told that the solution, if I had alcoholism, was found in the 12 steps, and that I could find freedom and I could find a brand new way to live. And what I can tell you is that's what I have found. By being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not a guy that has, once I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, not long after that guy came and made that 12-step call on me, I've never stopped being a member. I've never stopped trying to practice those steps. I immediately started praying. I'm not saying I felt good doing all that or that I even understood any of it. I was just taught to take actions that didn't make any sense, and that's how I would get better. I didn't have to understand it. And I even in the darkest days sober and doing crazy stuff, I've always tried to practice Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life, and have attended meetings and have been in contact with a sponsor. And I don't say that to impress anybody. I just say it. Somebody's got to say it. I mean, the idea that we have a revolving door and that it's okay to relapse, is it doesn't have to be that way. And I'm not trying to piss anybody off. I was sober 9 months, and I was in a meeting, and I had been attending a bunch of meetings. I had taken the steps. I had made amends. I'm living in the living room of my dad's house with my stepmom, who hates me because I stole a car from her not long before all that. And my wife has not come back yet. I suspect she's still sleeping with my cousin, and now she's sleeping with some bodybuilder named Jungle, which is not, it's not good. I mean, it's really not good for your self-esteem. And it's not good. I might need to do some resentment inventory on that. Still fresh sometimes when I think about it. But I was immediately thrown into service when I got sober, and we would take meetings to mental health. I'm sober five or six weeks, and there were some folks in this first group that I was in. And this guy that I looked up to had relapsed. And it devastated me. I didn't even know that was a thing. It was like, I didn't know it was an option. But it devastated me. I looked up at the guy, and he, one night in the meeting, he said that it really enhanced his recovery to relapse. And I'm like, jeez. And then a bunch of us all attended a lot of meetings, and people would be like complaining and like whining about their lives. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just happy to be sober. I'm happy to be not running the streets and causing problems. And my life was still just decimated. But there was something inside of me that was like, I'm grateful. And all these people were talking about these problems, and I had these guys telling me that I wasn't digging deep enough. Man, if you feel good, you're not digging deep enough. And it confused me. My sponsor told me not to worry about it. But then we took this meeting to this detox, and this guy, a different guy, had relapsed. And he made this comment that relapse was a requirement. So in my mind, it's a true story. In my mind, I'm thinking like, man, maybe I need to relapse. And I start questioning stuff, and I'm like, and here's what happened. Sunday night speaker meeting that a bunch of us went to, I was sitting in there, and this guy walked in, and when he walked in, he was dressed kind of like me. He was dressed up, and he had nice, his hair wasn't quite as good as mine, but he had really understand that more in a minute. But he kind of lit the room up. And he's walking around, everybody knew him, and people were shaking his hand, and he was talking to people, and people were like standing in line to talk to him. I'm like, what is this? Who is this clown? I mean, it looks, I'm mad because nobody's paying attention to me. Right? And anyway, his name was Tom Ivester. I know a lot of y'all know him or knew him. And but he got up to the podium, and when he got up to the podium, the first thing he said after he introduced himself was that he had been sober since his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard anybody say that. And he went on to say that he was not saying that to impress anybody or to set himself apart. He was saying that he just wanted people to know that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. And that what he had experienced and as a, being a member of AA was something more than just some kind of a first aid kit for alcoholism, was the term he used. And that what he found here was that we could have permanent recovery. We could have permanent sobriety. He didn't mince those words. That's the terms he used. And that he said that not only had he been able to stay sober since he joined Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to live that as a way of life, that he had found a new way to live, and that he was free, and that he was not burdened by his past, and that he didn't think that his disease was out in the parking lot doing push-ups or anything like that. That he had found power. Man, it changed the course of my life. I'm not even sure why I'm telling the story now, but other than that. That's been my experience, is that what I found here is it's permanent. And that no matter what life has thrown at me, I've been able to stay sober. This is not exactly right, but staying sober has been easy. Living has been a pain. And life visits. But I've never once thought about drinking. That's God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I've thought about doing some other stuff. Like running away, or maybe suicide, or you know, like man, this is enough. But the power that I have found here has been sufficient to get me through anything life has thrown at me. And I grew up in a family that man, there was a lot of drinking going on, a lot of craziness. It was chaotic, and people would be chaotic and crazy, but yet they kind of got along and kind of just rode with it. And I had I grew up with both my parents drank a lot. They'll say in AA that you shouldn't call people alcoholics. Well, I'll take a chance on some of my family members. They were alcoholics. I know you're not supposed to say it, but I think that's pretty accurate. And my dad, he had this big old afro and these pork chop sideburns, and they would just drink and party and just raise Cain. And he had tattoos. And you know, back in the 70s, not everybody had tattoos. I mean, if you had tattoos, you'd either been to prison or in like the Navy or maybe in a biker gang. And I think he had done all three. But he had this devil that was cool and this tiger. And then he had mom. And then he had this lady's name here that nobody knew who it was. It wasn't my mom. Wilma. And I don't think anybody's ever asked him who it was. But they would they'd have these parties, and people would come over and they would just raise the roof. And me and my brothers, man, it would be exciting at the beginning, but it would always end with somebody fighting or getting in trouble or a gun going off in the house. Just all kinds of stuff. Somebody would leave and they'd get a phone call later that they got locked up, and somebody would go get them out and they'd bring them home and they'd keep partying. And next morning, you know, we'd wake up and act like nothing happened. And it scared me, and I really thought I would never be like that. I can remember having these thoughts that I'm not going to drink like that or be like that. And with the same, in that same sentence, though, I was a guy that was just like Ron described. I was full of fear and just fell out of place, and I had all these voices in my mind just telling me all kinds of nonsense. I'm glad I found out that liquor would fix that at the age of 12. It took him a long time to figure that out. I think I would have probably attempted suicide, but I was in the basement of a guy's house, a neighbor's house, and we were just kind of curious, I think. And we started drinking Old Granddad 100 proof. I'm 12 years old. I'm full of fear. I don't understand what all that is, but I know there's just something wrong with me. And I got that whiskey in me, and my God, it lit me up like a firecracker. All that fear and doubt and confusion just disappeared. And I had a spiritual experience. And there's just no doubt about it. I can remember that night just like it's tonight. And the next morning I woke up in a pile of vomit. Couldn't remember anything that happened the night before. But what I remember was, my God, I didn't swear it off. I knew I was going to drink again. And I did. The next day or a couple days later, we went right back in the basement of that guy's house and started drinking that whiskey, and the same thing happened. All that fear, doubt, confusion went away. And I immediately knew that I was going to continue to drink. And I don't believe I was alcoholic at the age of 12. I don't think I was suffering from any kind of a disease. I was just a guy that was, I was ill at ease and just disconnected from the world, disconnected from any kind of help. And I found it in alcohol. And I just took to it like a fish would take to water. I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved the courage it gave me to stand up to bullies. I loved the courage it gave me to talk to girls. And, I mean, I just rolled with it. And basically what happened, I certainly didn't drink every day from that point on, but I drank every opportunity I got. I created opportunities to drink. I shoplifted alcohol and hide it out in the woods. We'd steal liquor from kids' parents when they were at work. We'd hide it out in the woods, and I mean, I drank just about every opportunity I got. And now, I started to get into a lot of trouble. Now, I'm not a guy that's got to drink to get in trouble. You'll hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll get in trouble today. We might get in trouble going home. Something might happen. I mean, it just finds me. But I don't drink. I don't have. You could argue I do better sometimes drinking than I do when I'm sober. And crazy. But what happened was I got kicked out of two different county school systems for stabbing people with pencils and making racial slurs to teachers and, you know, threats of violence and selling, they don't like you selling drugs in school either. And my parents would have to move around. I didn't even know anything. You know, I didn't even realize some of this until I got sober. But we would literally have to move so I could go to school. And now, I also know my dad did that too, because he was hiding. He was moving from girlfriends. He didn't want my mom to find out. I know, but I kind of know that now. So he was. I think I was actually helping him. he'd blame it on me. And, he's like. And anyway, what happened was I got into a bunch of trouble. Was facing going to prison. A guy that I was with ended up going to prison for 2 years, and I ended up going into the military to get out of trouble. And I went to the Air Force at age 18 with the idea that my life was going to change. I had all these grand ideas of proving to my family that I was going to be different. And I was it had nothing to do with drinking. No one's ever saying to me about my drinking at this point. They didn't want anybody, if they said something to me, then they'd probably have to look at theirs. So they, you know, but there were these ideas that I'm going to get some education and they're going to teach me how to, some discipline, and things are going to be different. Didn't happen. Man, I drank just like right when I got a basic training and got to my first post up in Rantoul, Illinois. I don't recommend going up there. It used to be an Air Force base over there called Chanute. And it was just south of Champaign. But anyway, I get up there, and they tell you all these places not to go. And, of course, those are the first places we go. And I start drinking like nobody's business. I start blacking out a lot. I can't remember what I'm doing, where I've been. I get in fights with people that I went to the bars with. I lived in a dorm with about 200 guys, but it was one of those dorms where they had two rooms, two guys stayed in each room, and then four people shared a bathroom. I woke up one morning, I'm feeling something cold on me, and I look around, I'm in a bathroom. It's not my bathroom, but I'm in the dorm. And I got some women's clothing on. I'm like, nah. Today it wouldn't be a big deal, but then, mid-80s, it wasn't cool waking up like a girl with 200 guys around you. And I was like, man, I wonder what happened. I was like, it's one of those times you're glad you had a blackout. You just don't want to know what happened. But things like this would happen, and I wouldn't think much about it. I mean, it was like, it seemed normal, you know, for stuff like that to go on. And I got married. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm a guy. I think that if I'm with the right person, or if I got enough money, or the right car, or the right place to live, if these circumstances outside are one way that things are going to be different, or things are going to be okay. And that didn't happen. What happened after I got married, we were both way too young. I often wonder why anybody let that happen, but my irresponsibility and my alcoholism really started to take off. I mean, I really started to get to the point to where when I started drinking, I absolutely could not stop. And I couldn't predict what I was going to do. And I'd stay gone for, you know, a couple days at a time. And my father-in-law was really the first guy that ever came and, like, said something to me about my drinking. And it wasn't long after we had gotten married. And the conversation didn't go very well. But he planted a seed in my mind. And I'm not a guy. I always knew there was something wrong with me. I never thought that I was normal, or never thought that things were on the right track. And I started to, inside, wanting to get my life in order. Early on, I don't think it was exactly like I'm going to quit drinking. I was like, man, today's the day I'm going to get it together. Today's the day I'm going to turn things around. It's going to be different. And maybe I won't drink. Maybe I'll do what I say I'm going to do. But I never could get it together, because I'd always start drinking. And once I started drinking, that was just the end of it. And one morning, me and two guys we'd been out riding the roads for about 10 days. And I started hearing these voices in my head telling me that I needed to get my life in order. And I had my younger brother had gotten involved in this in a church. And it appeared to have turned his life around. He kept telling me that if I ever need any help, to give him a call. Well, I called him this morning. That morning, after I couldn't shut those voices down, and I'll never forget when he answered. He says, "I've been waiting for the call." And I was like, "Okay." And I don't know what's wrong with me. I mean, I told him, I was like, "Man, I need some help." All I really thought I needed help was shutting the voices down that I couldn't stop. And he said, "Well, come on over." He says, "I'll take care of you." And it was January the 1st, 1988. It's a Sunday morning. He's getting ready to go off to church. It's just a wonderful day to get your life in order and make some New Year's resolutions. And so I go over there, and he's getting ready to leave to go to church, so I go with him. Now, I got these pants on that are about 4 inches too short. I got this old 70s silk disco shirt on with the big collar, and I don't know where all that stuff came from, but I rolled up in the church room that morning. I looked like Pee Wee Herman or something coming up in there, and people were like looking at me, and I got up there and cried in front of about 200 people, and they came up and laid hands on me and rubbed some oil on me, and not making fun of that, they saved my life. I mean, they were trying to help me. But what I heard was that my life was just automatically going to get better. They didn't say that, but that's the delusion that I lived in. And 3 days later, I'm drunk, and I'm right back doing the same thing. I stayed involved in the church. Was just living a lie. I would go in there drunk and hungover, and I'd go into the bathroom. Right, the guy would be in the middle of the Sunday morning sermon. And it's a hellfire and brimstone church. And man, he's just laying it down on you. And you know, every time he says something, it's like, how does that guy know I'm doing that? It's like, he must be following me around. But I'd get up right in the middle of the sermon and go in the bathroom and do some cocaine, come back in there and sit down. And looking back on that, was just dumber and just dumb. I mean, you're all torqued up and paranoid anyway, and then this guy is shooting stuff at you. You're like, devil to come up and just snatch you down. And you lose your buzz quick that way, too. It's like, and I would leave, and this guilt and remorse would settle in on me about the lies I was living and the things I was doing, and you know, and I just led to more drinking. I mean, I would just, and what happened for the next 6 months? I tried lots of ways to quit drinking and get my life in order. I would read books and I would pray, and I went and saw a psychiatrist. Didn't like that. I shaved my head one time. I worked with a guy that drank like I did, and I came into work one morning and his head was shaved. I said, "Man, what's up with your head?" And he said he had hooked up with this organization that believed that the problems of man stems from their hair. And it's a true story. Their program of, I don't think he said program of action, that just sounds good to me, but he's basically, you shave your hair off and that kind of signifies the old man dying or your old ideas go away, and then when your hair grows back, you're like reborn. It's like, man, I need some of that. I went home, I shaved my head. And that's how delusional I was. I really thought it was going to do something. I stayed sober for about 3 days. And I see a lot of people in here are trying it. I only got 3 days out of it. It might work better for somebody else, but I started listening. I'd listen to gospel music and preach to people at work, and I'd preach to people at work on break, and then I'd go out in the parking lot and take a swig off the Aristocrat vodka and pop a couple Percocets, and then come back in there like after preaching to them. I was just delusional. And what happened was, my wife, you know, she had left, and it wasn't unusual. She'd leave and come back, leave and come back, but she had left. It looked like she meant business this time, and I thought that my family, you know, if you'd asked me, I told you my family didn't care about me and that they didn't want to have anything to do with me. I got very, like, suicidal and depressed, and I thought that people were out to get me and the world was out to get me, and there was just nothing to live for. I had this old, this will confirm I'm not the smartest guy in the room tonight, this morning. I had this old dog that had mange, and the vet had given me this poison to kill the mange on this dog. And I had this idea, I mean, heck, if it kills mange, maybe it'll kill a man. And one night I pulled some of it up into a syringe, shot it up my arm, laid down on the floor of the house, the kitchen floor, and basically went away from here for a little while. And there was nothing like dramatic about it. I did it just as easy as I'd go over there and get one of those notebooks. There was just nothing to it. And I didn't make any phone calls or write any notes. I literally wanted to die. I was just done with the way I was treating my family. I just thought that the world would be better off without me, and it was just too much work trying to live and live that way. And I ended up in the hospital for about 5 days, and my dad was trying to hide. I was still in the Air Force. My dad was trying to hide it. They checked me into a civilian hospital under one of my brother's names. It was terrible. While I was in the hospital, I knew I would never go back to living that way. I literally thought I had some kind of spiritual, some kind of experience. Things were different. You know, I've got more knowledge now. Now, there's no way I could do that. And it devastated my family. I mean, they were just baffled at what happened. And I got out of there, out of the hospital. 3 days later, I was drinking. Now, the good news about that is I've never had mange. And I'm telling you, I think it's helped my hair as I've aged. Most of us lose hair when mine keeps growing. It's like, geez. Anyway, a little humor. that. But here's what happened. Was that this is classic alcoholism. This is big book Jim putting milk in his whiskey. I left Pope Air Force Base. I was about 3 days out of the hospital, 8 days from attempted suicide. And I left Pope Air Force Base. I got out of the gate, and my plan is to go straight home. And this voice comes up and says, "Man, you're making a big deal. I know that Mike probably could drink a few beers." Another voice comes on and says, "Man, you know what's going to happen. You better go home." Then another voice comes in and says, "Hey, if you just buy the little pony beers instead of the big ones, it'll be okay." Then another voice comes on and says, "Man, you better just ditch that idea and go home." And then this was the clincher. Another voice came in and says, "If you eat something before you drink the small beer, you'll be all right." And I stopped into a convenience store and I bought me a spicy, I'll never forget this, I bought a spicy Slim Jim and an 8-pack of Budweiser Ponies. And I ate the Slim Jim and then I drank the beer and I was off to the races. And when the book says that we have no effective mental defense against the first drink, that's what it's talking about. I mean, I could not bring into my mind with sufficient force what happened 8 days before that. The idea that my parents are trying to help me and I got a wife that's begging me to stay sober, none of that stops me from taking that first drink. The insane idea always wins out. And that's my main problem. That's the main problem that centers in the mind, is that I've got this obsession that I invariably turn to the drink thinking it's going to be different, or don't even think about it. I just do it. And I've got no defense against the first drink. That's why I need God, and that's why I need the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened was my family was baffled. They didn't know. I mean, they mystified. I think that's what the book says. And I got out of the Air Force, and I'm living like an animal. This little house that me and my wife had, it's infested with fleas. The electricity may or may not be on. We're getting ready to lose it. She's off with my cousin or Jungle or somebody. And I had just given up on life. And I had just kind of accepted the fact that my life was just going to end up being nothing. I was going to go into some miserable end. And I left the guy's house one morning with the intent of going to the grocery store and writing another bad check. And I really had no plans to get sober, for my life to get into order. I mean, and there was nobody after me. There was nobody doing any interventions or telling me what I needed to be doing. Everybody was just leaving me alone. I know now they were doing that on the advice of some people with experience, but I was walking down this old country road, best I could tell, it was about 6 in the morning, and I started hearing those voices again saying, "Man, you need to get your life in order. You need to do something. You need to stop this nonsense." Couldn't shut it down. And it's like I saw the truth for the first time. It was not a spiritual experience or some bright light. It was just like, "Man, you're a loser. You're a complete zero, and you've been a failure at everything you've ever tried, and you ain't gonna make it much longer." And I said two things out loud. I said, "There's got to be something better than this." And I said, "God, please help me." And I can remember that just like it's right now. And the next thing I know, through a series of quick coincidences, I was in that detox. I took a risk and called my dad, and he actually came and picked me up. I made a phone call at a complete stranger's house. He smashed the last lie that I had in me, which was that nobody cared. He came and got me, and my stepmom was cussing at him. She told him not to come get me. And when he came and I got in the car with him, I can remember when I sat down, the first thing out of my mouth, I looked at him and I said, "I need some help." And I had never said that to him. Had never sincerely said it ever, really. And it was like a burden lifted off of me. And all I can tell you is I haven't looked back since. I've been sober ever since. Immediately after that, he took me to that detox, and some strange things started to happen. A guy did a little assessment on me, and some really strange stuff happened. I told him the truth. The truth wasn't in me. I mean, it just was not in me. That was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And they put me on suicide watch. I was in a funny blue outfit. And the guy from AA came in and talked to me on a Sunday morning. He came. He took time out of his schedule. I mean, he probably had all kinds of stuff he could have been doing. But he came in there and talked to me. He didn't go to the soccer game or go to the guitar lesson or go to church or whatever it was. Nothing wrong with any of that stuff. But I often wonder what would have happened if nobody had come in there. Or if some nurse or something with no experience had come and talked to me. Or some psychiatrist who wants to hit me with some nice one-liners and some throwaway slogans. This guy came in and spoke from the heart. And I identified. And I wasn't real happy to be there, but I knew that that guy had something I didn't have. And what would happen to me is that I was immediately introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was introduced to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people don't know that Alcoholics Anonymous is actually a book. And and I was introduced to some guys and to a group that practiced and lived Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing else. And I was told that if I put half of the energy that I did into drinking, into my recovery, that I would probably make it. Didn't make sense to me then. It's a goofy saying, but it's absolutely true. What I wanted to do, and I was told that I needed to just give myself to the program, and I don't know what any of that means. What I thought I needed to do was, I needed you to give me some money so I could pay off all this debt. I need you to give me a place to live, so I got somewhere to live. I need you to give me a job, because I need money. I need you to give me a car, because I got to get back and forth to that job. Probably need a therapist and some medication. And most importantly, I need you to bring my wife back. I had two different guys tell me that I didn't need any of that, and that they were not going to help me with any of that. And now we always talk about like early people that help us or our sponsors, like they're really mean, and they're like, we kind of exaggerate that a little bit. I mean, these guys loved me, and they ultimately did help me. But their point was, you're the one that screwed all that up. I mean, what? That's not what you need. You need to. It looks like that's a cure for alcoholism, though. Give a guy a place to stay in a job, he's going to be all right. No. It doesn't work for me. It hasn't worked for a lot of people I've tried to help and sponsor. We need all that, but that's not the solution to alcoholism. They told me that I needed to take these steps, and I needed to try to get my life to a power greater than myself. They said that power can be whatever you want it to be. You don't have to be like ours. And, you know, that's what I did. I joined a group, and I started to take those steps, and I didn't understand any of it. I had a lot of questions and a lot of doubt. I was told that doesn't matter, just take the actions and a belief, and questions and answers will come to you later. You don't need knowledge. Knowledge is what gets us in trouble. And, you know, what happened was, my dad gave me eventually let me stay in his living room. It was uncomfortable. It was all get out. A guy took a risk on me and gave me a job. A friend of mine, let me borrow a car for a little while to get back and forth to the job. But I started going to meetings, and I took those steps. I did a fifth step at about 4 weeks sober. And I was just taught that this is how we stay sober and this is how our lives change. And what happened to me was, you know, at about 3 months sober, I realized the obsession to drink had left. I didn't do anything specific for it to happen. I just realized that I had gone through a few things with my wife and with a sister that had gotten killed in a car accident. I'm 3 months sober, and I woke up one morning and realized, man, I stayed sober through that. I didn't even think about drinking. I thought about helping my family. I stayed in contact with people in the program through that. And I started to realize, like, inside that this, whatever people are talking about, it works. And I started making amends. I had outstanding warrants at the courthouse. They told me I had to go down to the courthouse and turn myself in. I'm like, whoa, that's a little harsh. They're supposed to come serve you the warrant. They got to find you. You don't go down and turn yourself in. What in the world? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, you guys can identify with that. And I went down and turned myself in. You know what? It wasn't fun. It worked out. I stayed sober. And, you know, I'm a guy that I think Ron said, when I got here, I didn't say, here's my family. I know it sounds like we get sober and things just immediately get great and you love everything. That's not what happened. I don't know that I wanted to be here. It was safer and better than where I was at. And I don't know how I got the willingness to do what these guys were telling me to do, but I did it, and I started to get results. And, you know, me and that first wife got back together. I was sober about 9 or 10 months. That little house we lost, we'd gotten it back, and that guy that gave me the job, I started to do well on that job. And most importantly, I was helping people. I immediately started going into mental health, these detoxes, at about 30 days sober. At about 3 months sober, a guy took me to a jail or to a prison, and I was just brought up that the solution to your problem is helping other people. Doesn't matter what else is going on, that if you'll get out of yourself, your problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. If you get out of yourself and help other people, that you're going to be okay. That doesn't make a lot of this stuff just go away. I mean, eventually you got to deal with things, but that's the foundation of the solution. And basically what happened was, even in sobriety, like, life can get dark and you can screw up. I started stealing money from work sober, and I don't recommend this. Guy takes a risk on me and gives me a job, and I rewarded him by stealing money from him. That marriage I'm in, right, we're trying to make it work out. She finally realizes she likes other guys more than she does me, which was fine. But what happened, I'm 3-4 years sober, and I'm having problems with my relationship. I'm having financial problems, and it's God's fault. It's not my fault. Right? So I start blaming God, and people, you know, don't understand. And of course, now I'm not telling anybody anything. I'm holding on to this. And it's kind of like drinking, the stealing. On my own power, like, I'd wake up in the morning, like, I'm not gonna do any of that today. I'm gonna go to work and do my job. And I'd go to work, and next thing you know, I'm doing it again. And trying to work on my stealing problem made me a better thief. I got to have God's help with that. And what happened was, I finally got honest with my sponsor about it. And he's like, well, you know, there's some steps for that. I'm like, yeah, he said, you're going to have to go turn yourself in. I was like, whoa, that's harsh. And I can remember pointing out to him, like, look, it says here in the step that do so, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I'm an other in this case. And he's like, looking back on it, I can't believe I actually said that, but I did say it. And he did what y'all just did, laughed kind of like that. And so by this time, my wife has left. She's off with some Marine that she met at the beach while she was with my parents. And another not good for your self-esteem. And here's what happened. I thank God for good sponsorship, and for men in the program that have experience, that are willing to share their experience with us. And because they told me to do some pretty radical things. They told me to file for separation, which I didn't want to do. And they told me I had to go make amends to my employer. Now, on the employer, I didn't want to do it. I was scared, and I was told that if I wanted to, you know, get well and wanted to grow spiritually, that I was going to have to clean that up. So I knew they were going to fire me, and I really thought that they might press charges against me. Because the company had fired people for way less than what I did, and I just knew they were going to probably press charges, and I was prepared to go to jail. Because my sponsor said, "You don't have any kids, do you?" I was like, "No." He said, "Your wife's gone, right?" "Yeah." "So you're not responsible to anybody, are you?" He's like, I was like, "No." He says, "Well, then, you know, you're not another in this case." So, but I had already picked out the name of the meeting I was going to start in the jail, and once they locked me up, you know how the head works, right? And it just takes you to all kinds of crazy places, and it was going to be called the Breaking Out Group. But I made the amends to the employer. I told the owner of the company I needed to meet with him. I laid out what I'd done, and he looked at me and he kind of thanked me for working hard for him for the last few years, and he was glad that I was being honest with him. And he says "I've been forgiven for worse." And he says, "The best thing we can do is forget about this and move on." And then my first thought was, "Well, damn, I wonder what he did if he's been forgiven." I was so grateful. I mean, I'm grateful for non-alcoholics, friends and family that help us and that try to understand us. They don't get real good fair shake sometimes. None of us would probably be here if it wasn't for a non-alcoholic. And I paid the money back. It wasn't mine to keep. And they didn't fire me. I kept my job. I around the same time I got through the divorce. It was as amicable as a divorce can be. I mean, I didn't fight or argue or try to, you know, do something or keep something that wasn't mine. I followed some spiritual principles and got through it. And what I haven't stolen anything since then, and I haven't treated a woman the way I treated my first wife since then. And what happened to me was I there's been a lot of talk about it this weekend. I realized that I let fear, it's my main problem. I mean, I got fear, and I had fear that God wasn't going to take care of my financial situation, so I had to take care of it. I've got fear that God's not going to take care of my relationship, so I got to take care of it. And it's kind of like, I think Ron talked about it last night, it's kind of like the second step. I believe God helped me with my alcoholism and all this other stuff, but I don't believe that power can help me with anything else. It's not going to help me with this. And this is another one of those little small statements that changed the course of my life. I was talking to my sponsor about it after I made the amends and got through the divorce. And I told Paige, I was like, "There's not much written in the big book on steps 6 and 7. I was like, "Don't we need to do something else? Read another book, maybe drop some rocks or put on some new glasses or something like that." And nothing wrong with those books. He said, "No." He said, "If there was more you could do, there'd be more written." And I'm telling you, when he said that, it changed my life. A simple comment like that, "There was more you could do, there'd be more written." And he basically said, "Your job is to be done living that way. Your job is to be willing to change. And at some point, you got to give your whole life to the power, not just your drinking." And it just hit me, and I realized that I gave about 50% or 80%, that I had to go all in. And that he said, "If you're really willing and you want to change, that the power will show up to help you do the opposite of what you were doing." And, you know, in the middle of all that, it looks like I'm getting further away from the program, I'm getting further away from God, but I realized that through that behavior and that kind of walking, you know, by myself and taking my will back, it actually got me closer. Because the day that I gave up and stopped, that power was there to help me. And then I started to realize that really what my real problem was is that I didn't continue to try to live the steps 10 and 11 and 12 of our program. That I didn't continue to stay honest with somebody, even though I thought I was. I didn't keep taking my own inventory and sharing that with somebody and making an amends quickly. And I didn't try to grow in knowledge and power. You know, the 11th step says, I typically know the right thing to do. I lack the power to do it. That's what the 11th step is about. It says in there that we ask for the power to carry it out. And you almost never hear anybody in AA talk about that, or if you go to a meeting on the 11th step, we never talk about the power to carry it out. That's my problem, is lack of power. I have no more power to quit drinking than I do to quit stealing on my own. I've got to have God's help. And I find that in step 11, through prayer and through asking for it, and following some simple instructions about pausing through the day, talking to somebody, and praying. And then I practice principles in step 12. I try to do the opposite of what I used to do. I try to practice the principles of honesty and of open-mindedness and willingness and just being a good guy and loving love and tolerance. And most importantly, Alcoholics Anonymous it's given me a purpose. The purpose is to help other people. And outside of that, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me lots of other purposes and lots of other ways to help in the community and with family and with things outside of AA, but AA has always been the foundation for me for that. I didn't have any of that before I got sober. I didn't have any of that before I started practicing the steps as a way of life. So I've never turned from that. All the other stuff is a benefit of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was resentful with women after my wife left, and we've got till noon, right? Right? It's tough on Sunday morning. Everybody's wanting to go home and rub your wife on the butt or whatever it is. Let's see here. Oh, I'm good. Don't nod off on me. I stayed single for a couple years after I got divorced. Unusual for me, because I want to go jump into the next thing real quick. And I was resentful with women, and because I gauged every other woman by her and what I thought she did to me, and I swear the minute I got over the resentment. But first, being single, it was one of the best things I ever did. I never really say much about this, but I really kind of started to have relationships with other men. I started having relationships with my family that I had like avoided during that time. And I started to kind of realize what I actually liked and what I didn't like and what I wanted and what I didn't want out of life, by not being distracted and trying to make something happen and doing something that I know is not right. And the minute I got over my resentment, it's like a woman just popped up out of the floor. And it was easy, it was natural, there was nothing forced. And we dated for a little while and got married. I've been remarried now for about 26 years. And we don't try to change each other or fight or argue. I don't want to say we agree on everything. That sometimes it sounds like you just know. I mean, we don't always agree on everything. But I've got a good marriage today because I try to practice the program, and because people have taught me how to do that. Not because of anything I've done, but I've been a good husband because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed on that job for about 24 years. I went from basically sweeping floors and stealing money to I was a president of one of their companies. It's a Fortune 500 company. A lot of y'all use their products. I'm a guy with no education. I did stuff that there's on paper, it makes no sense. Absolutely makes no sense. Can't happen. And what I started to do after that, after I made the men's for steal money, I started applying exactly what I do at my home group to work. Started getting there early. Started staying late. I started doing things without being asked. And I started trying to practice traditions of just unity and including people and getting consensus. And I had an incredible work career there because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of just trying to, it's not about being perfect or being good, just doing the best I could. And that wasn't me. That's a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll share one story and then I'll sit down. I was sober about 7 years. And my mom, I had made an amends to my mom when I first got sober. It was one of those, and I'm sorry. And she's like, oh son, we're just glad you're sober. Just keep doing what you're doing. And it was, looking back on it, it probably couldn't have been any other way. And my mom she'd suffered from depression, some severe clinical depression, on and off through the years, and she'd go through these bouts where she would like start blaming her kids on what was going on. It all stemmed from her and my dad getting divorced years ago and some stuff my dad did to her. I got a call one night from one of my sisters saying, hey, mom's over here. She is just in a rage and in a fit. You need to come over here. I go over there. And she's just, it's something like you'd see on TV. And screaming and hollering. And I realized at that moment that when she saw me, she saw my dad. And anyway, normally what we would do in that case, we would do like what somebody that doesn't understand alcoholism would do to an alcoholic. Just stop. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, just forget about him. You know, do this, do that. There was no like talking to him or identification. And I didn't do that this time. I just let her go and I was like, you know what? And she would always say, you kids just don't understand. And I finally told her, I was like, you know what? You're right. We don't understand. And right when I said that, she's like, she didn't have anything to argue about. And I said, I don't understand. I said, but I'm willing to try to help understand if you want to try something different. And I prayed with my mom that night. First time ever. It just kind of came out of me. I prayed with her, and she laid down and went to sleep. Next morning, and I already told you this, what we normally do in the family is the next morning you act like nothing happened. Well, the next morning, I didn't let that happen. I said, we need to talk about what happened. And anyway, we had a conversation about it, and she got help. She almost immediately stopped taking all these medications they started putting her on. And she's been free from that ever since then. But I helped her get the help. I didn't just back off and say no. And around that same time, I realized that the amends I had done with her was just, it was feeble. I mean, it was just not very sufficient. And I told her, I said, I need to have a conversation with you. And I took her out to lunch. And I said, you know, I know that when I was drinking and running the streets and you raising me, it couldn't have been easy. And I know that I caused a lot of damage. And I said, is there anything I can do to... No, I didn't say that first. I asked her, I said, I never gave her the opportunity to talk. I said, is there anything you need to say about that or anything you want to talk about? And man, she'd been waiting for that. For 7 years. She just went on to how she felt about when they came and took me out of high school in handcuffs, took me to jail, and all the times that she got phone calls, people not knowing what was going on, and times she didn't get phone calls, wondering where I was at. She told me a story about where I was in a blackout and I basically kind of physically assaulted her uptown, this little town we lived in at the convenience store. I have no recollection of it. It's the first time I'd ever heard of it. And And she wasn't being like mean. She was just kind of just stating facts. And I realized the damage that I'd done to her. And a good friend of mine, Don Pritz, he's dead now, but he used to say, you know what you did to him, but you don't know what you did to him. And it came to me, the damage that I'd done to her, and didn't even realize it. And I asked her, I said, well, what can I do to make it right? And she said that the way I'd been living the last 7 years was amends enough. And that she appreciated me talking to her, and she appreciated the man I was trying to be, and that all she wanted me to do was to continue to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I'm not here for myself. I'm here because my mom told me to come. That's like, you ain't got no choice. Daggone it. But what, the main part of that story, though, is we in AA, we're always talking about me and my recovery, and you'll hear stuff that this is a selfish program, and we do this for us. It's just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, I know it's true to a certain degree, but that's not how we live. That's not the foundation of the program. It's unselfish. And I saw my mom become free because of my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what we did, I mean, a drunk alcoholic will impact tens and hundreds of people. A sober alcoholic can impact tens and hundreds of people in a positive way. And I saw, because of people like y'all and the steps and the power that I found, I saw my mom become free because of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's no longer worried about what I'm doing tonight or today. And if she needs something, she calls me and I do it. And as far as I know, I've honored every commitment I've ever made with her since then. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what AA is about. When I got here, I was just hoping to get a car and my wife would leave my cousin alone. And you know, what's happened to me is I have found purpose in helping alcoholics. I'm uniquely qualified to help another alcoholic, and I should never shuck that responsibility. That's why I got to stay on the firing line and help people. And I've been given freedom here. And I know not everybody experiences that, but I'm absolutely free today. I'm as free as anybody ever that I know. And that's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the power that I found here. So thank you.